You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 22nd, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hello, Governor.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everyone. On this date in 1844, it was known as the Day of the Great Anticipation, in which these William Miller and his followers prophesized that Jesus Christ would return to the earth during the year 1844 on this day, October 22nd.
Wow, how'd that work out for him?
Well, I'm glad you asked. On October 23rd is known as the Day of the Great Disappointment.
because I'm not making this up.
Because Jesus Christ did not.
Well, it turns out he was busy. You know, he's a very busy guy. Son of God, the whole bit. The guy's got a lot of things going on.
Yeah, it's...
That always reminds me of the restaurant at the end of the universe.
Zarquan, the great Zarquan.
Yeah, the cult's been waiting for his return for whatever billions of years, and he finally returns seconds before the end of the universe.
Yep. Steve, I was just thinking about that. I was just going to mention that too. Oh, God, we're just crazy geeks.
That also reminds me of another character in The Hitchhiker's Guide whose sole purpose in his life was to insult every single person that ever existed.
Zatiger, the infinitely prolonged.
I love that guy. What was he up to, like the bees?
I've done you before, haven't I?
Oh, God, it's awesome. Good. Well, we have Phil Plait joining us later on in the show to talk about a few things, including his new book.
Philly Plait.
But first, some news items. This one's from a couple of weeks ago, actually, but we haven't gotten to it with our live show and all. This is an interesting psychological study, the title of which is Lacking Control Increases Illusory Pattern Perception, by Jennifer Whitson and Adam Galinsky. So these are psychologists who did a study where they had subjects, they subjected them to this testing.
They were asked to complete tasks which had no rhyme or reason, and which sometimes they were rewarded for doing things and sometimes they weren't, and there wasn't really any control over it that they had. For some of the tests, they did that. For others, they just asked subjects to recall a time when they were out of control, where they lacked control in a situation. And then they had them look at these patterns, these kind of like, you know, scattered dot pictures, and tell the researchers what they saw in the images. And the people who were primed to feel out of control tended to see patterns more often than the control groups, which pretty much fits in with what some previous tests that we've seen.
The Rorschach tests and the ink blot?
Rorschach?
Well, no, it kind of looks like a Rorschach test. But the thing that this sort of confirms or helps confirm is the idea that when we lack control, we reach for, we kind of desperately grasp for any kind of pattern that we can make out as kind of a last-ditch effort to seize control. And you can kind of see it in the way that, for instance, some athletes who play sports that rely heavily upon chance tend to be more superstitious than athletes who are in sports that don't rely on chance. So it's kind of an interesting look at how or why we've developed this ability or this predilection.
Tendency
is a good word, for making up superstitions.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is an interesting study, although it is just one study. And any psychological study like this, there's so many variables, it's hard. You know, no one study could ever be ironclad because there's just, you know, there's so many variables and ways to interpret things. But this is a nice little study. And as Rebecca says, it does build upon a much larger body of psychological research that shows exactly what this study shows, that situations that make people feel out of control also enhance the tendency to believe in superstitions or in conspiracies, or in this case, which is interesting about this study, in just visual pattern recognition. So it's tying together all these things which we thought kind of were similar, but this is saying it actually is all the same psychological phenomenon.
Yeah, they did test the pattern recognition. They also asked some subjects to look at other things and see if they detected conspiracies or to see superstitious lessons in certain stories. And so they did test each of those things as well. And I was reading an article about it that said one example of another study that this builds upon is one that showed that first-year business school students are more prone to imagining conspiracies than second-year students, what they believe due to lack of control in first-year students. And also the idea that deep-sea fishermen have more superstitions and rituals than fishermen who fish in more like predictable areas of the sea. So it's definitely a compelling argument.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's because I do think it's one of the key sort of skeptical lessons that human beings have a tendency for this, you know, what we call hyperactive pattern recognition, and there is this emotional motivation underneath it. So being aware of the situations in which superstitious belief systems arise is a way to rise above it, to overcome it. And that's kind of what skepticism is all about, really just overcoming the pitfalls in human thought processes. The next item to talk about is yet another solar breakthrough. Believe it or not, we actually don't talk about every solar breakthrough that comes down the pipe because there's so many of them. But occasionally, since I do follow these news items, yeah, meaning solar energy breakthrough in solar energy, that occasionally I see one that I think rises above the others and is worth mentioning. So we've spoken in recent months about ways of almost doubling the efficiency of cheap solar panels by using that sort of popcorn structure of these light-absorbing material. There was another, I think, news item where it was discovered how to have, like, if you imagine a window, when a photon of light impacts the window, it gets conducted through the pane to the edge, where, and you could have a solar panel around the edge. So it's a way of increasing the surface area that is absorbing the light. And then, Bob, recently we talked about the one using like a photosynthetic process in order to store solar energy and also other types of energy, which would connect solar collectors to a battery or some storage mechanism, which is important for solar power to become viable. Well, in this one, there's pretty much every variable that is out there, they're finding ways of maximizing it. Researchers have discovered how to create materials that absorb a greater range of wavelengths of light, which basically means it would absorb more of the spectrum of light from the sun, because the sun emits the full visible spectrum, and you want to absorb all of it if you want to maximize the energy that you're going to be converting into electricity.
Well, plus, it goes beyond the visible spectrum, obviously, but
yes, right,
make
but
that clear.
Yes, that's true, but it's peak in the visible spectrum.
And coincidence?
I don't think so. Obviously, we evolved to take advantage of that. So, within physiological constraints. So, this is pretty neat. This has the potential to dramatically improve the efficiency of solar panels. The other thing it did, which is really interesting, is that this new material, which they say is a hybrid of several other materials,
California Sensimilla.
it's a hybrid.
A hybrid of conductive materials, including molybdenum. I always like saying that word. And titanium.
You like that word, Steve?
Molybdenum? Oh, yeah.
Molybdenum.
And conductive plastics. But in addition to greater wavelengths, this material would also, in response to photons hitting it. Now, most solar panels, it works through fluorescence. Now, fluorescence is the process of absorbing a photon and then, you know, re-emitting that energy as an electron, right? Or the other way around. Basically, you're absorbing energy and almost immediately releasing it again. You know, fluorescent light bulbs do that by fluorescing, you know, in the visible spectrum. In solar panels, you would absorb the photon and release electrical energy. In nanoseconds, it happens almost immediately. But this substance also phosphoresces. And the difference is that if the energy is held on to by the material for a longer period of time, which could just mean microseconds instead of nanoseconds. Although some phosphorescent substances can hold on to that absorbed energy for minutes or even hours. And in fact, like glow-in-the-dark objects, like if you have those items which glow in the dark, those phosphoresce, and they use materials that will slowly release the absorbed light energy over hours. The reason for this, I don't really understand the physics at really a meaningful level, but the simple version that I was able to understand is that when the energy gets absorbed, the states required to release that energy again, they're technically prohibited quantum states, but that just means that they're extremely unlikely. So it takes a long time for that energy to be released again. Now, this material, they say, would hold on to the energy 7 million times longer, but that only takes it up to about 83 microseconds, which is still a small amount of time. Bottom line, longer wavelength and also using more than one method of absorbing and then readmitting that energy, both fluorescence as well as phosphorescence. And that all adds up to getting a lot more energy out of the same amount of light impacting upon a solar panel, which is, you know, these are the basic science advances that I think are in solar energy that, you know, keep me excited about this technology. And it's so many different things, you know, that would all, you would think, have a cumulative effect on improving the efficiency, the cost effectiveness, and the usability of solar energy.
Steve, could you repeat that part?
The part after...
What, like from the beginning.
Yeah, part after good evening.
You know, Steve, does it seem very odd or unusual that to you about the solar technology just seems... It's just a different story every day. It's just amazing me how often they make this what seems like a significant breakthrough. You know, some of them don't pan out, and I'm sure some will, and some will require effort. But doesn't it just seem inevitable that within 10 or 15 years, we're going to have just some kick-ass solution that just puts petroleum to shame? Doesn't it seem inevitable to you that we're really going to hit on this?
It certainly seems that way, but of course you never can tell. You can't predict future technology. But I think this reflects the fact that there are just so many people researching this. I mean, it seems like these are all different research groups coming at it from different angles and making different significant improvements in,
right,
you know, in solar technology.
And so, the potential payout is so huge.
Yeah, and I imagine it's because of its ubiquitousness, if that is a word.
Ubiquity?
Ubiquitudinosity.
You don't need enormous sums of money to do all these
kinds of research
all in
also,
the same field.
I was getting a little worried. I've always said that a lot of this research into alternative energy might wane once if the price for oil goes down, which it clearly has from 130 down to back down to 70. But I think that we've got a critical threshold with solar technology. There's no stopping this steamroller. It's just going to plow forward until we have something that can really, really make a contribution. I don't see it slowing down. Even if we got down to, you know, $30 a barrel again, I think this is just going to, the research is going to continue and not abate.
I hope that's true. There are other factors at play other than just the price of oil. There's also environmental concerns, and there's also national economic concerns. You know, we don't, like in the United States, we import 60%, more than 60% of our oil. So even if it becomes cheap, there's still a huge motivation to try to reduce our dependence upon imported oil. At least for now, you know, there's a lot of research money obviously being put into it, and that will last for a while. You usually get 2 or 3 years out of a pulse of sort of research funding. The question is, you know, will they be able to achieve some tangible return on investment in that time, enough to keep the funding going? Because you can envision a scenario in which there isn't any immediate payback, the funding starts to dry up, and then we could go back to it being on the back burner for a decade or two, especially if the price of oil has come down. But again, I agree with you, Bob. I certainly hope that that doesn't happen. And it all depends, I think, on the next couple of years on if some of these things come to fruition, meaning that there's actually a company making solar panels and making money off of them. You know, that will then keep the funding stream going. But we'll just have to wait and see. Jay, you looked into this most recent UFO story that's been buzzing around the internet.
Yeah, I'd say it's pretty typical of a very old story that's being remembered and described to by the person involved, you know, 50 plus years later. This information was originally published by Britain's National Archives on Monday. So this was actually information, I guess, that was held in the archives, and they released it on Monday. So the story goes, on May 20th, 1957, during the height of the Cold War, an unnamed American pilot and another airman were flying from a British air base, and these guys were ordered to engage in fire on a massive UFO that lit up their radar. This guy named Milton Torres claimed to be the pilot, and he was interviewed. And he said that he never saw a UFO with his naked eye, but he saw an aircraft carrier-sized blip on his radar. And this is him recounting what was happening. He said, "All of a sudden, as it was coming in, it decided to take off and leave me behind. The next thing I know, it was gone. It was some kind of space alien craft. It was so fast, it was so incredible, it was absolutely death-defying."
Yeah, that's the line that struck me. He says it was some kind of space alien craft. How did he make that leap? He basically he never saw it. It was just a radar blip, and he just throws in there, and it was an alien spacecraft. Well, what was the information that led him to that conclusion?
Well, he contradicted himself because he admitted that he never saw it with his naked eye. Yeah. I think they're going on the size of the blip, and they're all because it was described as the size of an aircraft carrier blip that mm-hmm. they were following. And then, it did the typical, and it suddenly disappeared. Right. So let me read a little bit more about what he said. He said, "I had not the foggiest idea what had actually occurred, nor would anyone explain anything to me." And then he said he was led to a man in civilian clothes who advised me that this would be considered highly classified and that I should not discuss it with anybody, not even my commander. Then he continues to explain, "He disappeared without so much as a goodbye, and that was that as far as I was concerned." So the men in black showed up, smacked them around, said, "Don't say anything." Then that guy magically disappears, right? Everybody's mm-hmm. Lots of things are disappearing with this guy. And then talking to the second pilot, who was also included in the files, he painted a different picture of what was going on. He said that there wasn't one but several unknown objects that were on the radar, and he didn't have any recollection of being contacted by the men in black and being told to stay quiet.
So they're both reporting this in like 2 years ago, you said? Are these 50-year-old memories?
I think these interviews happened, I think, in 1988.
Oh, so they were 30-year-old memories.
Yeah, but these interviews were just released, though.
Yeah.
But one of the things I found most interesting about this article was that somebody named David Clark, who is a UFO historian and who's interested in understanding the psychology behind why people believe in UFOs, he basically studies the phenomena of people believing in things like UFOs. And he actually believes that people do see UFOs, but he considers them to be...
unidentified?
Not mundane, but, they could be
meteorological?
Weather-related.
They could be weather-related. They could be other phenomena occurring, but he didn't come off like a true believer after reading his website. He just sounded to be more of like a someone studying the concepts behind why people believe these things. Very interesting guy. But he said that the CIA once had a program intended to create phantom signals on radar and that this may have been an exercise in electronic warfare. But he agrees that whatever the case may be, that something unusual did happen that day. He does believe that something unusual happened.
Right. Well, there's a few things we can conclude about this. One, 30-year-old memories, worthless. They cannot be used as a firm basis for any conclusions. That there's multiple possibilities here, either that this was just a radar malfunction, because really all we have is a completely radar phenomenon here, right? Nobody saw anything. Mm-hmm. Nothing was shot down. There was no encounter except on radar. You could be a radar malfunction, or it could be certainly maybe testing some way of gaming radar, of creating phantom signals.
Yeah, the whole thing was based on the radar. There was nothing physical.
It could have been a legitimate Soviet incursion into British airspace to test the reaction of the British air defense system. Or it could have been something unknown.
There are some things that are explainable about it, and I just think this is a good example of how people will turn something that did happen into something a lot grander. But, of course, at the end of the day, there's still no solid evidence. There's no proof. There's no physical proof. There's nothing.
Right. At the end of the day, there's still nothing. Right. Well, let's move on to your questions and emails. First one comes from John Pollard from the UK, and John writes, I am emailing from my iPhone while listening to you lot. What a great time we live in. Astonishing technology and intelligent discussion on tap. Blacklight Power recently made renewed claims as reported in the New York Times online. I don't see a lot of skeptical chatter on this. I found a brief mention on Skeptic and reasonable coverage on Wikipedia. I would be very interested to hear your views given the high-profile backers who I read are invested in this. My gut says that it is nonsense, but who said that they prefer not to think with their gut? John Pollard. Well, thanks for the email, John. We'll have the link to the website and some articles about it. Let me read you a little bit about the process, and you tell me what you think. Based on physical laws of nature, Dr. Mills' theory predicts that additional lower energy states are possible for the hydrogen atom, but are not normally achieved. They are not normally achieved because transition to these states are not directly associated with the emission of radiation. Thus, the ordinary hydrogen atom, as well as lower energy hydrogen atoms, termed hydrinos, are stable in isolation. Mills' theory further predicts that hydrogen atoms can achieve these states by a radiationless energy transfer with a nearby atom, ion, or combination of ions. And then it goes on from there. But so what he's talking about is the energy state of a hydrogen atom. Now, according to our current models of quantum mechanics and how, you know, atoms work, there is a minimal energy state, so-called ground state. That's sort of the lowest shell that electrons can fill. Electrons, as they go into higher, you know, you could think of them as orbits, even though they're not really orbits. They're called electron shells. As they go into higher electron shells, those are higher energy states. And there are these discrete states that differ by a certain quantum. That's actually where the concept of quantum mechanics comes from. There isn't a continuum of states. There's actually these specifically quantum of states. As energies go into higher states, electrons, they need more energy. As they go into lower states, they give off that energy. And if they get enough energy, they actually get kicked off of the nucleus entirely. So you could get energy out of an atom if its electrons go to the lower shells and they give off the excess energy of their higher shells. But once you get to that ground state, the lowest energy state, that's it. There's no more energy to be got out of that atom. What Mills is saying is that he's saying that there's actually a state of hydrogen that's below the ground state, and that there's a tremendous amount of energy to be had, more than in any chemical reaction, although not as much as you would get out of a nuclear reaction. And that therefore, with his catalyst, this catalyst process where you could force hydrogens into this hydrino lower energy state, you can produce tremendous amounts of energy.
How do you get it into the lower state?
Well, through his patented process, using some kind of catalyst.
I'm skeptical.
How do you falsify that?
Yeah. So this is crap. This is complete fantasy.
Below ground state, give me a break.
Below the ground state, right. This is free energy, nonsense. This is, rewriting the physics textbooks kind of stuff. And also, a lot of red flags here. Again, it's touting this one guy, Dr. Mills, who's supposed to be this super genius, who is, rewriting the laws of physics, but hasn't published any of this anywhere in any peer-reviewed journals, right? So
no.
What are the predictions that flow from this new way of this new concept of energy states, and where's the research that shows that any of his fundamental principles are correct? There's a lot of hand-waving kind of promotional kind of statements and arguments that are made for it. None of the things that should accompany a revolutionary idea in physics. New predictions, studies that validate those predictions, resolving actual problems with the existing models, none of that. What we have is a lone guy making outrageous claims and asking and getting a lot of money. The other thing you have is that his promises of milestones are always just out of reach, forever being pushed back and pushed back.
Well, he's got all the red flags down, doesn't he? He read Dennis Lee's book or something.
Yeah. Oh, this is Dennis Lee territory. Although this guy, I think, has some scientific background, so he can talk the talk. you know, he starts talking about going below the ground state. Okay, that's more, a little more scientifically sophisticated than your Dennis Lee, who's a free energy, you know, con artist, or a lot of other guys selling stuff. So I think that's probably why he was able to garner as much money as he's had. By reports, he's had $25 million worth of donations to his company, which he founded in 1991, including some high-powered people, which is then gets used to sell it to other people. You know, it kind of has a snowball effect. If you get some big names to donate to you, that gives you the credibility to then con the next person down the
line. 17 years, and he hasn't even written a paper about this stuff?
Yeah. And then he keeps saying, again, it's just around the corner. And then in 2001, he promised he would have a working device, and then that never manifested. Then in 2003, he said, in 2 months, I'm going to be able to do this demonstration. Then that never happens. So multiple failed promises, all I need more money, I need more money. And then, of course, the conspiracy theories start coming in about how it's being repressed and suppressed by the powers that be, et cetera.
New science, which is so scary. I don't want to see
right.
it. Oh, God. Physicists would be jumping all over this if there was anything to it.
If he's taking this to such a level of a more sophisticated level of science, yet he's trying to earn to plead for money out of people.
Yeah.
Who basically don't get science, for the most part,
right.
don't understand science to begin with. I don't see how he gets money based on becoming more scientifically, a little bit more sophisticated. Wouldn't that just make people scratch their heads more and maybe not want to give money because they really don't understand what the heck's going on?
Yeah, but if you talk a good talk, if it makes it seem like you understand what's going on and you can break it down into, like, don't worry about all the nitty-gritty details of the physics and everything. You know, you explain it in a way that's complicated enough so that somebody who's scientifically illiterate will be impressed by it. But then you tell them what this really means is that we can get 100 times the energy out of a gallon of water as you can get out of a gallon of crude oil. And then investors hear that, and the dollar signs light up in their eyes, right? And they start writing checks for millions of dollars. So that's what's been happening. And because this guy has some scientific credentials, it all sounds more legitimate.
Right.
And then it's just a matter of how long can I stave off the investors and the public and the media when I've continuously failed to produce any actual results, you know?
Obviously 17 years.
Obviously 17 years. Yeah, it's amazing. And now it's coming up again, and you know, you need more investors. You get some reporter from, you know, from a newspaper to write about it, you know, credulously, and anything to get your name out there. And you get another round of, you know, again, scientifically illiterate people donating money to you.
I don't know. If I'm gonna write a check for like $5 million to give to someone, wouldn't you like, you know, hire a physicist and say, "Hey, what do you think of this stuff?" You know,
you should. Yeah, you would think
spend
so.
Spend a few bucks,
do a little bit of vetting.
And Bob, like,
let's say not 9 people out of 10, or even 99 people out of 100, in fact, do that. But it doesn't make any difference how many people turn you down. It's only how many people can you get to accept your con, right?
It's true.
Yeah, there was a great This American Life on a while ago, actually, but you can find it on their website, where they interviewed basically one of the garage physicists, like a guy who thought that he invented a free energy machine in his garage. And they accompanied him to an actual physicist who took a look at it and told him that, you know, it just would never work. And the interesting things were to see how the guy reacted to that, and also to hear from the physicist when he would talk about exactly how many people come to him with these crazy devices every year. It's like he just gets bombarded, and a lot of physicists now, like higher profile physicists, get so many requests from cranks to look at their own special free energy machine that they really believe is going to work, that they've just taken to just not answering the phone, just deleting the emails as soon as they come in.
Yeah, it's incredible how many cranks there are out there.
Yeah, there's a good likelihood that even if he did want to contact a physicist about it, they just weren't even interested in talking to him about it. And I can't really say I blame them, unfortunately.
Right. And then this guy, Mills, gets to say that mainstream physicists aren't interested in this because they don't have the imagination or make up your excuse.
Yeah.
Or the people who are funding them don't want them to be interested, you know, and that's enough for some people. This is so old school that Robert Park deconstructed this guy In his book Voodoo Science. I mean, so this goes back all the way to that, which was in the, this guy's has already been debunked, whatever, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
Doesn't deter him.
Well, let's go on with our interview. We are joined now by Phil Plait, the bad astronomer and now president of the James Randi Educational Foundation. Phil, welcome back to the Skeptic's Guide.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Hey, Phil.
It's always a pleasure to have you. We're talking with you tonight. We have a few things to chat about, but primarily we are having you on to plug your new book, Death from the Skies, which is coming out in stores this month, correct?
Yeah, it's already out, as a matter of fact.
And it's in. You can get it through Amazon and in your local bookstore.
Yeah, it's wide release. So unlike my first book, which you could find under the occasional rock or rotting log in a forest, this one's everywhere.
So we've talked about the book a little bit before, but why don't you give us the quick overview? What's the book about?
Well, it's about $26. Ba-dum-bum. Thank you. Here every Thursday. Well, the title's not terribly misleading. It's actually about all the ways I could think of that astronomical events could wipe out life on Earth. And we're talking asteroid impacts, giant solar flares, exploding stars, black holes, the end of the universe, colliding galaxies, magnetars, just everything. It's a laugh riot, in fact. It's the feel-good hit of 2008.
Yeah, it must have been a very depressing year for you writing that book.
Well, not so much. I've thought of most of these things before, although one or two of them surprised me either with their magnitude, you know, the amount of death they can deal in under a minute, or you know, reading about the end of the universe, and there were a lot of different ways that came up, and that was a little bit of a downer. But the other ones were just ones I had thought of in the past, and it was just kind of fun to research this stuff. And my attitude toward it was, you know, not to just say, we're going to die, but was just take a scientific viewpoint and to make this more like a roller coaster ride or a horror movie. Make it fun, make it exciting, and in the end, you know, don't try to scare people out of their pants. Actually say, look, you know, how many people do you know have been killed by a gamma ray burst? None. So, you know, don't lie awake at night being terrified about these things. They're just cool to read about.
Yeah, Bruce Banner survived it, so...
What I found really cool was that you had to pull from a lot of different disciplines when writing it. How much research did that take?
Well, I pretty much knew all this stuff because I am a genius.
Yeah, you are a super brain, but...
I'm actually a walking brain. Communicating to you from a jar in a laboratory. It was kind of interesting because I knew a lot of the basics of a lot of this stuff. But when I started really researching it, it's really different to describe something and write it down and try to make sense of it. And so when I was researching this stuff, I'd read the book or I'd read a paper. I was reading a lot of papers, and it was interesting. And then when I sat down to try to type this up, I realized I don't know anything about magnetic fields that I thought I did. And, well, happily, two of my friends are solar physicists, and they were able to walk me through a lot of this, although one of them has warned me that not everything I said in there was 100% accurate, so I'm sure in the second edition, second printing, I'll have to go back and make some minor changes. But he said everything's pretty close. It's close enough to not worry about. But, you know, that's just one of the pitfalls of this. The first book, my book Bad Astronomy, these were all just misconceptions, and so it wasn't that hard for me to research and cover the basic ground of this. But in a book like Death from the Skies, where it covers things like the details of an asteroid impact, the details of why the sun blasts out solar flares, even something I'd studied for years like supernovae and gamma ray bursts, when it came to the details of what happens at the moment a black hole forms in the core of a star, I realized I don't think I understand this. And that was actually funny because I called an expert. I called the principal investigator of the SWIFT NASA mission, which investigates gamma ray bursts. And he was the one who actually helped me with that chapter. And I said, you know, I don't really understand this and this. And he said, that's okay, nobody does. And I went, oh, cool. I'm not as dumb as I thought.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely true, is that you don't realize whether or not you completely understand a topic until you are tasked to explain it to somebody else.
Exactly.
And that really challenges your understanding of a topic.
Yeah.
One of the things I really liked about the book was that, of course, you know, each chapter you're talking about a way in which some astronomical phenomenon can destroy the Earth. But in order to explain it, like on the one about a supernova, or even just the one on solar flares and whatnot, you have to go into the background of how stars work and you know what the life cycle of a star is. In the end, it's kind of a textbook on stellar astronomy. You know, for for a layperson. Hang on.
It's like a dictionary. It's that much fun to read. Yeah.
No, but you gotta let me finish my sentence, Phil. But it's like a textbook, except that it's organized around a really cool story. Not just, all right, here's a systematic, you know, walk through, you know, these dry facts like a textbook would do. It's you're telling a story about how something cool can happen. But you need to have that background knowledge. So it's like it's a way of presenting the information in a very functional way, thinking about the implications that it has. And I think it's a really good way to learn stuff, and it also makes it much more compelling. But there's a lot of facts in here. You're not just storytelling. I mean, the point is you learn quite a bit of astronomy, you know, working through these chapters.
Well, each section, actually, each chapter starts with literally a fictional story, a vignette about, you know, what would happen if you were standing there. And that was kind of fun. That was sort of the first thing I'd written was about a guy waking up in the morning. He's sort of an Arthur Dent kind of guy. He wakes up, he's brushing his teeth, and he looks out the window. Instead of a yellow bulldozer staring at his house, exactly, he sees an asteroid burning up in Earth's atmosphere and impacting just over the horizon. And then, you know, what happens to this guy and in the next minute or two.
I'd love to see that.
No, actually. I have a fairly good imagination when it comes to this stuff. And believe me, if you read that opening vignette, you realize, standing there would kind of suck.
Is there any way to see a really spectacular, you know, meteor burning up through the atmosphere without it being also the harbinger of your own death?
Sure, just don't have an impact. Just skip off the atmosphere. You know, just plow through it. There's actually I've seen videos of a fairly big meteor careening through the atmosphere, and it never actually hit.
There was one in the 1970s taken out in the over near the Rockies. I think I don't remember the exact location. It was one of the first good. Well, it wasn't video. It was actually film. Some of the best footage taken up to that time. But then in the 1990s, a chunk of rock about the size of a school bus that came in heading northeast over West Virginia, and it came in over Pennsylvania and New Jersey and New York, and it exploded in the Earth's atmosphere and dropped pieces all over the place. One of the pieces landed in Peekskill, New York, and hit a woman's car, and you can find pictures of that. But it happened on a Friday night, and so there were a lot of people out there with video cameras because they were videotaping the high school football games. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a lot of footage of this thing, and astronomers were able to not only get the exact path of this thing, but backtrack it to actually calculate an orbit for it. Wow. And we have pieces of this thing. So that was really awesome.
Hey, Phil, I hear about that every now and then, a meteor coming in or a comet, and it explodes. Now, do you mean it breaks up, or does it literally explode? And if so, what causes the explosion?
Well, an explosion, pretty much by definition, is a sudden release of a lot of energy. And so when a big rock comes into the Earth's atmosphere, you can imagine something a couple of meters across, but you know, the size of a small car. And it's a few tons, you know, 10, 15, 20 tons, something like that, comes screaming in at, you know, Mach 40. It's coming in at 20 miles per second or some insane rate like that. As it starts to hit the Earth's atmosphere, a lot of people think it's friction with the atmosphere that heats it up, but that's not true.
It's a compression, yeah.
You're right, it's compression, it's ram pressure. If you take a bicycle pump and pump it really quickly, as you compress that air, it heats up. And so that's what's happening with the meteor, and it's coming in and it heats up the Earth's atmosphere, and that's why it gets hot. But there's also a tremendous amount of pressure on the rock itself, and so it starts to flatten out. It's called pancaking, and as it flattens, eventually you exceed the tensile strength of the rock. You exceed its ability to hold itself together, and it starts to break apart. Well, when you break it apart, you're increasing the surface area, which means you're heating more of this thing, and then they break apart, and you're heating more and more, and literally within a few seconds, this thing dumps all of its energy into the atmosphere, and you get an explosion. That's what happened over Tunguska in 1908 in the remote Siberian swampland. There was something about this about 100 meters across, 50 to 100 meters, something like that. Nobody's really sure how big it was, and it exploded. This was a multi-megaton explosion. And if it had happened over London, you know, about a million people would have died within an hour or two of the fires and the explosions and the Glavin. It would have been awful.
But one of the things you wrote in that chapter on asteroids, which I had not heard the idea before, you talked about, like, how could we avoid it if we can measure and track Earth-crossing asteroids and we know one's going to hit. What could we do about it? You know, you talk about
build a big jet engine on the Earth and push the Earth out of the way.
That was a Futurama episode, actually.
But blowing it up probably wouldn't work, but you could push it or pull it with different techniques. But one thing you mentioned, which I hadn't heard before, is we could actually just go there, especially if it was like a metal, like an iron or nickel asteroid, and just mine it and just slowly cart away all of the material. And it occurred to me, although you didn't talk about this, that it would probably, if we were going to do that, it would be a lot cheaper to take all of that iron to the moon rather than down the Earth's gravity well. And we probably could use all that material if we were building moon bases and stuff.
Well, that's true. The moon doesn't have a lot of heavy elements, and it doesn't have a lot of iron and nickel and zinc and platinum and the kind of stuff that you need to build a base and build your computers and to eventually have a nuclear explosion which blasts the moon out of Earth orbit. For your Space right. 1999 fans, three of them in the audience. Thank you. If an asteroid is mostly made of iron, you know, an asteroid a mile across is worth a lot of cash on the market. And if you go there, it's almost in pure form just sitting there. And so you just have to mine it and get it somehow back to the Earth. And if one of these things is coming towards the Earth, the last thing you want it to do is hit. And it turns out you can't bomb these things despite, you know, every stupid movie. You can't send Bruce Willis there and have him blow up the asteroid. It doesn't work. What you want to do is gently push this thing out of the way, and you might, you know, you could land a rocket on it upside down and try to push it that way. Turns out that doesn't work that well because a lot of asteroids are rotating or tumbling, and so that makes it hard to point a rocket. What one group wants to do, the B612 Foundation, this is a group of astronauts, astronomers, scientists, engineers, they're investigating, you know, what do we do if we see an asteroid with our name on it? They have this idea of putting a probe near the asteroid and letting the gravity of the probe itself pull the asteroid. I mean, we're not talking about something the size of the moon. We're talking about an asteroid that, you know, is a mile across or less. So even if the probe has a mass of a couple of tons, the gravity is really weak, but it's still enough to pull this thing out of the way. And then if you're going to pull it out of the way anyway so it doesn't hit the Earth, maybe you can put it into an orbit that orbits the Earth, and then it becomes easy to land a mining operation on it. And then you send Bruce Willis and let him go up there and dig iron for the rest of his career. And that's killing two birds with one stone.
We get rid of Bruce Willis. Three birds.
Or what do you think about putting it on a collision course with the moon? Would we have the precision to do that? So that, in fact, we could do that prophylactically and just clear out the Earth-crossing asteroids by just smashing them all into the moon before we build a moon base there. And then we have all of that, you know, iron or nickel and stuff on the surface of the moon, assuming it didn't hit too deeply.
Well, that would be just totally cool. Woo, big boom. Wow, that'd be great.
To see that. Watching
it's not
that.
Like, it's not like you'd need a lot of precision to hit the moon. It's 2,000 miles across, so it's a big fat target hanging out there in space.
Yeah.
I don't know the physics and the math off the top of my head to be able to calculate if it's easier to hit the moon or if it's, you know, easier. The easiest thing to do is just have this thing miss the Earth. And then, you know, calculate the orbit after it passes the Earth and see if it's going to miss the Earth for the next 1,000 years. And if so, you know, wave bye-bye and you're done. On the other hand, if you've spent all this money to start tugging this thing around, you might as well do something useful with it. And it, hitting the moon at 20 miles per second is still, you know, that's a pretty big bang. And it's going to bury itself in the lunar surface, and that's going to make it hard. You might as well just mine it there and build a, like, say, a mass driver on it, a series of magnetic loops that'll accelerate, you know, packages of iron, and they can come in and decelerate in the Earth's atmosphere and then parachute down the rest of the way. Mm-hmm. And it would, you know, if it's copper, it would be pennies from heaven. How do you like that?
Right. Now, we have an asteroid in our lifetime that's going to be coming very close to the Earth in 2029.
Apophis.
Ah, that would be Apophis. Yeah. This is a 300-meter-wide chunk of rock. I think it's rock. That in April of 2029 is going to pass so close to the Earth, it's actually going to pass between us and our geosynchronous satellites. Wow. So we're talking, you know, a razor's edge as far as these things go. And the thing about Apophis is that it's coming so close to the Earth that we don't exactly know what's going to happen once it passes us. Now, it's not going to hit, But if it passes really close to the Earth, then the Earth's gravity will swing it around into one type of orbit. But if it passes a little bit farther out, the Earth's gravity won't bend it as much, and it'll be in a different kind of orbit. But if the Earth's gravity bends it, you know, just right, if there's that Goldilocks thing, that what they call a keyhole in space, if this thing passes through the keyhole, 7 years later it comes back, and in April of 2036, it's going to whack us. And so we're very interested in keeping our eyes on this one. At a meeting recently, I talked to Rusty Schweikert, who is an Apollo 9 astronaut, and he's very interested in this. He's with the B612 Foundation. And he said with even a couple of years' notice, if in 2029 this thing swings by, hits the keyhole, we could still delay 3 or 4 years to get a probe to this thing. But even with only 2 years' notice, he thinks we could be able to tug this thing out of the way with a gravity tug so that it would not hit the Earth again, which is astonishing. But, you know, good. That's good news.
Yeah, and we'll surely be motivated if we determine that that's what's going to happen. You know, talk about, you know, being motivated to do something.
That would be an extinction event, something that size, right?
Talk about a bailout, the trillion-dollar asteroid bailout fund.
It wouldn't wipe out humanity, but that would be an enormous explosion, far larger than any nuclear weapon that's ever been blown up. The largest that was ever blown up was 50 megatons by the Soviet Union back in the 1960s, I think it was. This would be hundreds and hundreds of megatons. It would be maybe even thousands. I'd have to do the calculation.
Gigaton.
But maybe, yeah. It could easily be that much. And so that's not something you want to be screwing around with. You want this thing to miss. Mm-hmm. And it just occurred to me, this actually had not occurred to me until you mentioned this, but a conspiracy of astronomers could get together and say, listen, we got to say this thing's going to hit because otherwise we're not going to get any funding.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, they're going to hand us a check for $1 billion. And maybe we need Paulson to help us do this. That might work.
There was a science fiction novel, I think it was called The Great Eye or The Red Eye or something, where there was a planet, I guess like a small planet, entered our solar system and was headed for the Earth. And astronomers told everybody it was going to hit the Earth and everyone was going to die, like in 2 or 3 years. But they were lying, and they lied deliberately because they thought that it would bring everybody together. And in fact, that's how it played itself out in the science fiction novel. But that
isn't that an old novel from like 1950?
Yeah, it's very.
I think it's called The Big Eye.
The Big Eye.
I got a question, something I've thought about in the past. What if we could take Apophis and shove it into an orbit that is identical to Earth's, going just a tiny, tiny bit faster than the Earth? So basically, at some point in our orbit, this thing is going to come upon us, but at such a low speed, because we know the big problem with these asteroids hitting the Earth is the amazing kinetic energy released because of the velocity. You know, they're going warp 20 coming in there, 20,000 miles an hour, 10,000, whatever. The kinetic energy is just so gargantuan. But what if it was going so slowly that it just kind of just bumped up to Earth? I expect the gravity would pull it in and accelerate it. But, I mean, how fast would it come in if it was going just a tiny bit faster than the Earth and in the same orbit?
Yeah, you'd think that, you know, like in a race car or in a movie when you jump from one car to the other. As long as you're matching speeds, that should work. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way because the Earth's gravity is so strong. The minimum speed of a collision is 7 miles per second. That's the Earth's escape velocity.
Wow. Oh, wow, wow.
So even if you had this thing, even if you had this thing come in and at some slow orbit, if you ignored the Earth's gravity, this thing would just come in and bump us. But because the Earth does have gravity, this thing would come in at 7 miles per second. It's just the way the physics works out. There's no way to get it in coming slower.
And that's enough still that it would wipe out cities.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
7 miles per second's fast.
Yeah.
You know, it's much, much faster than a rifle bullet. And something 300 meters across coming in that fast is going to do a serious amount of damage.
Phil, one of the cool things, speaking sort of on the same subject, I actually found that your book was very optimistic when it came to situations like this, how humanity might be able to overcome death from the skies. And the idea of us doing that with, a giant rock flying at us is one thing, but you also present some viable possibilities for how very far into the future we might actually be able to overcome or at least stave off extinction when, for instance, our sun dies and things like that. How much of that is just speculation? Are you really optimistic that humanity could go long enough to even face that problem, let alone overcome it?
You know, I'm concerned about the next election, let alone, you know, a billion years from now. And the sun right now is nicely fusing hydrogen to helium in its core, and it's got enough hydrogen in there to last for, you know, several billion years. But every day, the core of the sun, where all this hydrogen and helium is, it's contracting. As there's more helium piling up from the fusion process, the core gets more massive, and its gravity increases, so it gets denser. And if you take a gas and you compress it, it heats up, and the core of the sun is essentially a gas. So the core of the sun is heating up, and that heat is leaking out, and it's heating the sun up. So today, the sun is warmer than it was yesterday, and it'll be warmer tomorrow, although by, you know, a gazillionth of a degree, just a little tiny bit. But every day, over millions of years, that adds up. And in 100 million years, the sun is going to warm up enough to warm up the Earth enough to actually boil away our oceans and cause a runaway greenhouse effect, all these really big disasters. So, you know, if we want to survive this in the long run, and let me add, you know, this is not even the sun turning into a red giant. That's going to happen in about 6 billion years. The sun is going to swell up and consume Mercury and possibly Venus. Probably not the Earth. The Earth will, as the sun loses mass through its solar wind over billions of years, the Earth is moving out from the sun. And it's kind of a race right now. Are we going to move out far enough so that when the sun swells up, it'll miss us? But either way, when half the sky is filled with a red-hot glowing star, you know, the Earth is going to get fried. Even before then, even 100 million years from now, we're going to want to do something about this. And it is technically possible to move the Earth, our entire 6 sextillion ton planet, away from the sun. Now, you don't strap a jet engine onto it. I don't know where you guys went to school.
It's a movie. I saw it in a movie.
Oh, well, then it must have been true.
Superman.
You didn't see it on the internet. It probably wasn't true. But these guys, actually, I read a fascinating book called The Five Ages of the Universe, and it talks about deep time. It's going to happen in, you know, a Google years from now, and they talk about this problem of, not in the book so much, but they've written a paper, the same authors, Fred Adams and a couple of other guys, they wrote a paper about what do we do about the Earth when the sun heats up. And they talk about taking an asteroid a few miles across and moving it, maybe using this gravitational tug, and swinging it past the Earth and using a gravitational slingshot effect to actually give the Earth's orbit more energy. And that moves the Earth away from the sun a little bit, a few miles. But if you do this every 5,000 years for a million years, you can actually move the Earth out quite a distance, and you can move it to a safe region. It's pretty astonishing.
If you miscalculate, sounds like you're pretty screwed, though.
You'd heat the Earth up a lot. A six-mile asteroid is what wiped out the dinosaurs, so you don't want to screw with this.
Yeah, a few billion years, though, I think we'll have some pretty cool tech.
Well, you would hope that, you know, 100 million years from now, we wouldn't need a planet to live on. You know, it may be moot point. When our disembodied consciousnesses are floating throughout the galaxy like some sort of weird Isaac Asimov story.
Yeah, right.
The thing is, the physics of moving the Earth is not that complicated. And you basically pass this asteroid by the Earth, and it pulls on the Earth, and the Earth moves out. Then you shoot that asteroid past Jupiter, and you steal some of the energy from Jupiter and then let the asteroid pass by the Earth again. And so this thing is like a conveyor belt for orbital energy. It takes it from Jupiter and gives it to the Earth. Jupiter moves in a little bit, but the Earth moves out a lot, and you save the planet. And I just thought that was so awesome. I had to write about that.
That is cool. That's very cool.
Yeah, that never occurred to me.
I can't wait to see it.
Pack yourself in a big Tupperware container, and you'll live for 100 million years, and you can live to see this.
Well, Phil, I'm really enjoying the book. It's a very easy read. It's funny.
Lots of small words.
Reading some of the sentences, it's impossible not to hear you in my head reading the sentences.
That's funny because I actually hear
book
Phil in my head no matter what book I'm reading.
The electronics are working then. Excellent.
It's a pretty serious problem, actually.
I mean, sometimes you write exactly like you lecture, so I can hear like would say something like the sun is really, really big, and you actually have that second really in italics because that's how you would say it. It's so great.
I was concerned my editor was going to start hacking that stuff out, and I said, you know, look, you signed me up to write this book.
Yeah.
I pitched it and everything, but I'm the one writing it. And she was like, yeah, sure, you know, this is your voice, go for it. And I thought, yay. So my editor, Alessandra Lusardi at Penguin Books, Viking Penguin, was awesome, and she was a really big help in making sure that, you know, my voice was in there, but not, you know, so much that people wanted to, you know, stab an ice pick in their eye after reading this.
No, it's great. I mean, I think this is exactly the sweet spot of popularizing science. You have a good theme. You know, you have the very compelling vignettes. I felt that they were actually the funnest part of the book to read. And then while you're going through it, you're learning a ton of real, you know, good science. So I think it's perfect, actually.
Yeah. He said funnest, didn't he, just now?
Funnest.
Most fun.
Everybody there? Hello? Testing? Okay.
Most fun.
I think you need an editor too, Steve.
Unfortunately, I'm my own editor. That's the problem.
Yeah, right.
Well, when I was writing the book, I was trying to get it for, you know, I was trying to aim for that level of making this fun, making it exciting, getting the science in there, but making it like, you know, I'm holding your hand and showing you, hey, take a look at this. This is pretty cool. Don't be scared. You know, and one of my big goals with this was not to terrify people. I want to scare people, I mean, in a fun way, like a fun house being scared and screaming, going, wah, and then everything's fine afterwards. But one of the things I do is I fight a lot of pseudoscience from the doomsayers, the Mayan 2012 end of the world and Planet X and people talking about this stuff. And there was talk about an asteroid that passed by the Earth just a few months ago, and these guys were saying it was going to wipe out life on Earth even without hitting us. And this is all pseudoscientific garbage. And so I wanted to hit the right note with this and say, look, even the odds of getting killed in an asteroid impact are only roughly 1 in 700,000. So, and that's the best odds of dying by one of these things. There are no stars near the Earth that can blow up. The sun's not going to turn into a red giant for billions of years. We're not going to collide with the Andromeda Galaxy for 2 billion years. You don't need to really fret about this stuff. But you can read about it and get an impression of how much violence and how much energy is being tossed around by these objects. And that's where I wanted to go with this.
So, Phil, while we got you, there's a couple other things we wanted to discuss. We actually do have an announcement to make, you and I. We were waiting to have you on the show to do
what?
That. Tomorrow we are going to...
Getting married. Oh, no. Sorry.
Tomorrow we are actually launching a new group skeptical blog. And this is going to have you and me, as well as Michael Shermer, Brian Dunning, Kirsten Sanford, Mark Edward, Yao Man Chan, and Ryan Johnson. Anybody know?
Is it that cross-dressing blog?
We were going to go with that theme, but we decided at the last minute to change it over to, you know, we figured maybe we'll do something skeptical. But you guys know what all those people have in common?
Cross-dressing.
We're the skeptologists. This is
skeptologists.
Oh, right.
All skeptic proctologists. That's right.
Skeptical proctologists. That's right. So, you know, this is sort of has two purposes. One purpose is to just be a very high profile group skeptical blogs. There are people like, you know, Michael Shermer doesn't have a blog, and he wanted to have a blog to contribute to. Same thing with Brian Dunning, you know, who does Skeptoid. But for the rest of us, the primary thing is also about promoting The Skeptologist, which is the working title of a, you know, a pilot skeptical TV show that we're all still, you know, very excited about. Brian and Ryan, the producers, are, although we don't have any, you know, milestones or announcements to make about the show being picked up at this point, they're very happy with the progress that they're making. I think I'm allowed to say that. And this blog is going to be a component of sort of promoting the show and all the people on the show. But as well, regardless of what happens with the show, our goal will be to make it a new hub for skepticism on the internet, a high-quality group skeptical blog with obviously a lot of talented people. We have very experienced and popular bloggers like Phil Plait, you know, on board. So
who?
Yeah, and I'm really glad about this too, because honestly, I don't have many opportunities to promote myself. So this is great for me.
Right? Yeah.
Well, I'm not getting any really good laughs out of you guys. Is this thing on? Hello.
I don't think it's the microphone.
We have a laugh track that we throw in later. You know, the audience laugh.
So that will launch tomorrow, meaning Thursday. So by the time the podcast is up, it will already be up, and that is skepticblog.org. So check it out. And that's Skeptic with a K, of course, the correct way to spell it.
Oh, we're going to get emails now.
You're right.
Yeah, from Australia. Yeah.
While we have you, I also wanted to chat about some astronomy in the news, or at least space news. It was announced, I believe, just today or yesterday, that India has launched their first moon mission.
Yeah. They have actually been launching rockets now for a few years and doing Earth-orbiting satellites, but they now have a very ambitious mission. And, you know, I don't speak the language terribly well. It's Chandrayaan. You can find, if you just look up Indian space moon probe on the web, you'll find it. And this is a pretty cool mission. It's going to settle into orbit around the moon in early November. And it's got 11 scientific packages on it, including a high-resolution camera, which is actually stereoscopic. It'll take images right after each other and make 3D images, yeah, as well as what's basically an altimeter. It's a laser, sends laser pulses to the surface and then uses timing to measure the topography of the moon. It's going to do mineralogical studies. It also has a little probe. It only weighs about 30 kilograms, so it's not very heavy. And it's going to drop down to the moon and take video all the way down, and it's got a little Indian flag on it. I think that was a pretty good idea, actually. And this is great. Out of the 11 instruments, five of these were built internally in India. Two were done by the U.S., and the rest were done by other countries. So it's a really multinational mission. It only cost like $80 million. Which is basically free. Mm-hmm. That's not bad.
Hey, Phil, can I borrow some money?
Can you convert that to rupees?
When it costs you, you know, a couple of $100 million just to get into space, if you want to take a pack of matches into space, that's how much it costs. So $80 million is not bad to get this thing built and launched and getting out there. So, you know, this is interesting with China just having launched three astronauts into space with a spacewalk. And they've got their eyes set on the moon as well. So this is really turning into a multinational effort, and that's something I'm really glad about. Now, the United States is going to launch something called the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is going to map parts of the moon in super high resolution. We're talking 18-inch resolution. This thing will actually be able to get pictures of the Apollo hardware on the moon if it's aimed correctly.
Awesome. Nice.
I don't know if they're going to aim it at those spots. NASA would have to have their heads so far up their butts not to do this.
Please do.
That would be
so
the
nice.
Biggest PR.
Part of the
that
conspiracy, Phil. Part of the conspiracy.
Exactly. Oh, if they don't do it, you know it's going to fuel the conspiracy theorists for another generation.
And if they do it, they won't believe the results anyway.
That's correct. And I keep telling people that you know, if they didn't believe the gazillion images we brought back from the moon in the first place, they're not going to believe more NASA images now. And the other problem is that the ultraviolet radiation from the sun has probably dissolved the nylon in the flags. And so they're going to say, yeah, I see that everywhere, but where are the flags? And it's like, well, the flags are gone. Sorry. It's going to be red, white, and blue.
I didn't know that.
Whatever. Yeah. They're just nylon flags. And so they're probably long gone.
Well, that sucks. Why didn't they think of that?
Well, let's hope the Indian flag that they're sending up.
Well, Phil, thanks for joining us again. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me on.
Good luck with the new book.
Thanks,
good
Phil.
Luck with the JREF.
Thanks, Phil.
Thank you.
And good luck with that new blog.
Yeah, you too.
Thanks. Talk to you soon.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fake, fictitious, and false. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week, first time in a long time. Now, I generally try to avoid neuroscience items in the science or fiction.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a few good ones this week, so I decided just to pull them together. So the theme this week is neuroscience.
I'm shocked.
Ooh.
And here we go. Mm. Ready or not. Item number one. A new study demonstrates that synesthesia can be induced in normal subjects through hypnosis. Item number two. Scientists have discovered how to selectively and safely erase specific memories and have demonstrated this in mice. And item number three. Using transcranial magnetic stimulation, researchers were able to implant an image directly into the visual cortex of a subject.
Hmm.
Evan, go first.
Can you give us a definition of synesthesia? Please?
Synesthesia is when two sensory modalities or two cognitive modalities cross over. So seeing numbers or... hearing smells,
Steve.
Things like
hearing
that.
Hearing smells, right. Seen, yes,
seeing numbers is
that.
A normal thing.
Seeing numbers as colors, for example, is what I meant.
Yeah. Right. If it does happen, so why can't it be induced in subjects through hypnosis? Okay, plausible. And then scientists discovering how to selectively and safely erase specific memories have demonstrated it in mice. That sounds least plausible, I think, but I have a feeling it's actually true. There must be a way to judge the memories of mice, I guess. You have to have a baseline there of some kind. And then transcranial magnetic stimulation. Yeah, those magnets, you know. Implant an image directly into the visual cortex of a subject. Well, I just don't have that much faith in hypnosis being able to do something so extremely what is probably complicated in the brain. I don't see the connection between the hypnosis and the synesthesia. So I'll say that one is fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
Ah, crap. Well, I am really unsure. I did not do my required reading this week, unfortunately.
So you're flying blind.
I'm flying blind. However,
sometimes that's an advantage.
I feel like
not today.
The hypnosis thing is, you know, I think Steve wants us to pick that because it does seem kind of ridiculous.
Worked on me.
You can get an effect. You know, hypnosis can be used for non-bunk purposes. So, yeah, it's out there, but I think it's possible. Safely erasing specific memories is trickier. I saw this in Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and it wasn't as easy as they had planned. And everything I see on TV or movies is true. So, yeah, as opposed to implanting an image directly into the visual cortex of a subject, that sounds more plausible to me than safely erasing specific memories. So, plus, how do you know if you've erased a memory in a mouse? Do you have it flip through an old photo album and point to its baby pictures? I'm not really sure. So, I think...
Yes, that's exactly
that's
how
ridiculous.
It is.
Oh, that's so ridiculous.
Well, how else do you... Okay. Okay, there are probably better ways to do it, but I'm going to say that that is fiction.
Okay, Bob?
Using hypnosis to induce... synesthesia. That's wow. That's pretty out there. That would mean that the ability is latent in everybody, which is an interesting proposition. Because it seemed to me, from what I've read about it, was that these people are very special that have these abilities.
That smelled good. What you just said, Bob.
Yeah. Thanks. Erasing specific memories. I have heard of studies of erasing memories in general. Not specific memories, which was the problem. Like, how do you make sure you erase, you know, the traumatic episode you had, and not memories about your mother or whatever? I could definitely see somehow how that's happening and how they could do that. And testing it, I don't think would be a problem with mice. It's always you could just test their familiarity with things that they should be familiar with, like
or
a
cheese
maze,
or something,
a maze or whatever. Yeah.
Or cat.
The TMS, the transcranial magnetic stimulation, that's a fascinating device that I've read articles of all these fascinating things that it can do, but implanting an image directly into visual cortex, I've never read anything that's even remotely close to that. That would be cool. I don't think that's real. I'm going to say that is fiction.
Wow.
All right. Jay, we're all over the place, so you had a wide open field here.
Break the tie, Jay. Break
well,
the
I
tie.
Would tend to agree
Go,
with
Jay.
Bob. About the transcranial magnetic stimulation. So, you know, Steve, help me out here. I just want to clarify. Like, is this like, should I imagine this as like an MRI-type machine, or is this like a helmet that the person's wearing?
It's like a helmet that they would wear that would use a magnetic field to alter
meat
brain
helmet.
Function.
God, you know, I would just love it if they could do something like this, but it just seems a little, if I just take this one by itself, it seems a little science fiction-y to today's science. And I don't know, I'm looking at the three of these and it's like each one of them just hits me in the wrong way. Like I guess I realize I just don't know much about the human brain. I don't have any gut reaction to any of these being blazingly correct or incorrect. Talking about the erasing memories in mice, I mean that's a tall order too, but I don't know how they're doing it, but I don't know, like, you know, erasing a memory would mean just obliterating some pathways. But from what I understand about how memory works, it's distributed. So I don't know how they would actually cleanly and selectively erase one memory when it's distributed throughout the brain. The first one we had a new study demonstrates that synesthesia can be induced in normal subjects through hypnosis. I mean, when you put the word hypnosis there, I want to instantly just throw up the big BS flag. I don't know. I just don't know if hypnosis can do that. I just don't know if hypnosis can really do anything. And so, okay. So, to pick one of these three.
Jay, you're becoming the new Bob.
No, they're all fascinating, though, and it's difficult because I...
Pick a pony and bet it.
I don't know. All right. So, anyway...
It's cool that two of these are real.
Out of the three of them, I would just have to say, I just don't believe that we can implant an image in somebody's mind. That out of all of these, that one just seems to be the most far-fetched. So I'll go with the last one.
Two Total Recall, huh?
Alrighty. So yeah, this was a tough week. If I had been handed these three items without obviously reading the studies, I would think that they're all implausible in some way. So let's just take these in order. Item number one, a new study demonstrates that synesthesia can be induced in normal subjects through hypnosis. Evan, you thought that one was fiction, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that one is science. Uh-huh. And yeah, you know, you hear hypnosis and you have to be at least a little suspicious of it. But things can really be done in hypnosis in terms of even getting their brains to function a little bit differently.
It's a lot differently.
The things that are changeable about brain function is the proportion with which different parts of the brain are functioning. And some brain functions are inhibitory. If you enhance an inhibitory function in the brain, you can actually significantly turn off the function of some other part of the brain. And that could actually change the net effect of brain function. So the thing that's really implausible about this was the conventional wisdom that people with synesthesia, which again is one modality bleeding over into another, that they had increased or more robust connections between those two areas of the brain than the average person. Right. So there might be more connections between their auditory cortex and their visual cortex causing that connection. What this study says, well, let's just take people who have no history of synesthesia, of this bleeding over effect, and then give them a hypnotic suggestion that, for example, the number 7 is red. And then see what if they actually perceive it that way. And one of the tests that they did, because they didn't want to simply rely upon subjective reports of what color the number is, they had a black number 7 on a red background. Now, people who have synesthesia where they
couldn't see it.
They couldn't.
Holy
crap. Yeah, people with synesthesia can't see it. If you see numbers as colors, and the people they gave the hypnotic suggestion to, some of them also could not see it.
Wow.
So what they think is happening is what I said is that maybe through the hypnotic suggestion that they were actually disinhibiting, if you will, this sort of connection between the two parts of the brain, so that there actually is a strong connection there, but it's normally inhibited. And that they were disinhibiting that connection through the hypnotic suggestion. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that would be cool.
Let's go on to number two. Scientists have discovered how to selectively and safely erase specific memories and have demonstrated this in mice. And this did remind me of was the Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Soul, which mind. At the time
spotless
I saw that
mind.
Movie, of Spotless Mind,
yeah.
Yeah, we're far away from doing anything like that, even if it would be plausible. But that one is science.
Yeah, that was awesome.
This is very, very interesting. And what these researchers did, this research comes mainly from Dr. Joe Tsien, who is a scientist and co-director of the Brain and Behavior Discovery Institute at the Medical College of Georgia School of Medicine. And he's been doing a series of experiments, a research program looking at the molecular basis of memory. In other words, at the cellular level, what receptors, what proteins are actually responsible for the formation of memories. And he's made some interesting discoveries. And this latest research flows out of those discoveries. What he found was that if you increase the amount of a specific protein while recalling a memory, that memory you're recalling gets erased.
Yep.
So the specificity for the memory comes from the fact that you're thinking about it at the time. Now, what he did with mice, the model he used for memory was, which is typical what Bob said, you know, just it's the typical stand-in for mouse memory is you have them run through a maze and they learn the maze and that's their memory. But also, you may teach them locations where there's food, or you may teach them a location that's associated with a very painful event. And then they will learn to either where the food is or to avoid that event, that the location that gave them pain. In this case, they learned a location that gave them a painful shock. And then they introduced the protein into the mice in a situation that would make them, that they would associate with the shock, and then they basically unlearned that information.
Yeah, that's a hard thing, I would think, is to,
yeah.
How do you make a mouse think of something while this thing is happening?
Right. Yeah, it's always difficult to have an animal model of things like that are cognitive. But they do, you know, this kind of research has been going on for years. They've thought a lot about how to do that. So it's still, of course, it's, you know, again, no one study is definitive. This is a research program that has to get played out and replicated. But this is pretty solid research that's building step by step on, again, the very molecular model of what's actually happening at the cellular and protein level. So congratulations, Bob and Jay. Actually, but I didn't talk about number three yet, right? So using transcranial magnetic stimulation, researchers were able to implant an image directly into the visual cortex of a subject, and that is fiction. We cannot do that yet. I was somewhat inspired by a real news item, as well as several news items, actually, that made me do that one. But new research looking at how the brain learns to see. So for the first time, we actually caught the visual cortex in the act of actually changing its wiring in response to mapping to visual stimuli. But what's neat about this study is just that, you know, the way cortical connections are being formed and then reformed in a dynamic way. So especially the visual cortex is very plastic, and they actually saw that process in process. But also, there's been a couple of recent studies. I blogged about one of them using transcranial magnetic stimulation has been in the news recently.
Really?
There was a study showing that it's effective for depression. So just very quickly, transcranial magnetic stimulation using magnetic fields in order to, you can use it in one of two ways. You can use it to inhibit the conduction or the function of neurons in the brain, or to stimulate the activity of neurons. So you can have actually opposite effects depending on how you apply the magnetic field.
What a tool that is. You could just turn on specific parts of the brain. I mean, what a tool.
Yeah, combined with fMRI, you know, the TMS, you know, being able to turn on or off different parts of the brain is really helping us understand how the brain is hooked up and, you know, so-called reverse engineer the brain. It's a tremendous tool. The one downside of all this is that, you know, the people hear that magnets can...
Oh, God.
Can heal, you know, can treat this disease or treat that, and then this sort of lends credibility to the vast market in magnetic therapy pseudoscience, which is all has nothing to do with this and is not supported at all by this kind of research, but is sort of used falsely to lend credibility to a huge, again, pseudoscientific market in magnet therapy. So congratulations, Bob and Jay. Good job.
I'm so happy.
High five.
This was tough this week. This was a tough one, I think.
Easy. Piece of cake.
Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
Okay, I have a quote. This is from Enrico Fermi, and he said or wrote, "There are two possible outcomes. If the result confirms the hypothesis, then you've made a measurement. If the result is contrary to the hypothesis, then you've made a discovery." Enrico Fermi!
And who was Enrico Fermi, Jay?
Something about Fermi Labs or...
Oh, Enrico was a... He was an Italian physicist, most noted for his work on the development of the first nuclear reactor.
Right.
And this quote was sent in by a listener named Seridwin Lloyd. And my God, I hope I pronounced that correctly.
Lloyd? Yeah, probably. That's a great quote. Yeah, it may not seem that profound at first, but actually that's really critical that when we come up with unexpected results, that actually is really cool. That's an exciting discovery. It means there is something else that we going on that we need to learn about. Contrary to all the science deniers and pseudoscientists and paranormalists or whatever who say that scientists don't like disconfirming results or mysteries,
gosh,
and we always want to just support the status quo, that's BS. Scientists love it when results prove that there's some huge mystery out there that has to be discovered.
Oh, yeah.
And to think, Fermi said all of that in just a few short words.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Very pithy. Well, thanks for joining me again this week, everyone.
All right, thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.